the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Hedy Lamarr was the most beautiful actress of the golden age of Hollywood. Her first film, Ecstasy, contained a shocking nude swim scene that propelled the actress to fame. Her films included Algiers, Take Me to the Casbah, Boomtown with Clark Gable, and the epic Samson and Delilah. She was also an inventor and a composer. Stephen Michael Shearer is my guest. His new book is the biography of Hedy Lamarr, and it is called Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr. Stephen Michael Shearer, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much, Gary. I'm glad to be here.
I really enjoyed getting to know the woman behind the actress in the pages of your book. But tell me, why did Hedy Lamarr consider her beauty to be a curse?
Well, it's kind of hard for most of us to fathom from the day you can remember being told how beautiful you are. But indeed, she was a beautiful child, a beautiful young adult, a beautiful older woman. And she knew that that beauty would buy her wherewithal into whatever life or career she chose. And she utilized that to a great extent. But because it was a curse was primarily because she was never taken seriously. A woman of her era who had that type of beauty, especially a woman who was an actress, her beauty was what was primarily noticed, certainly not her ability as an actress or her mind. And unfortunately, she found herself dismissed in many situations, not only dealing with her career, but also with dealing in conversations. People were always surprised that there was a mind behind the face.
And a very interesting mind, according to your book. But also, I think maybe it's interesting because I think there's two distinct sides of her, the side that was able to concentrate and be a good actress and an inventor and all those things, but also she seems to be a very impatient person, that impatience might have been a curse as well. I mean, for instance, did she ever meet a man that she did not marry?
Well, she met lots of men that she did not marry, but she definitely was a very complicated individual. One would think, looking at her objectively, one would think, gee, if I had that beauty, I would use it this way or that way, and I would know how to manipulate my way through life. Unfortunately, with Hedy, she was a product of her time, a product of her era and her environment. She was raised in a very complicated and life-threatening environment when she was a very young woman, and she was involved politically, actually, in what was happening in Europe prior to her coming to America in the late 30s. So basically, there were a lot of complications in her life, a lot of which she brought upon herself. And as I say, she was an extremely complicated individual.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that she brought upon herself. I mean, sometimes I'm reading along, and all of a sudden I read something that just knocks me out. Like, you know, at one point in the story, she's a very devoted mother, and then a few chapters later, she hasn't had any contact with her son for 10 years.
It is strange. I tell you, Gary, as a historian, as a writer, one has to love their subject, and there was a point during the process of my writing this book that I did come to love Hedy Lamarr a great deal. But I also found that I didn't like some of the choices she made, especially in her personal life. One doesn't know why those choices were so extreme sometimes, like you said. She adopted a child, which she later abandoned. That, to me, doesn't make sense. But I think Hedy didn't like certain complications in her life at that particular point in time. When she more or less abandoned her child, basically disowned him. However, she did pay for his schooling, and in the final analysis before her death, they were reunited. But my concept, most of us, our concept of a family and love doesn't include just shutting somebody out like that. And that, to me, I found difficult to like about her. There had to have been reasons that I tried to find. This was not a psychological study, this book, but reasons that I tried to analyze, and I couldn't put my finger on it. But speaking with her other two children, it was just basically Hedy at that particular moment in time could not deal with handling an emotional situation like that. That is just one particular case in her life.
Well, I can feel when I'm reading your book that you're struggling with objectivity and you don't want to judge her. But at the same time, I made a joke earlier about having never met a man she didn't marry. I mean, she was married several times.
Yeah.
and some of her marriages, she got married at one point to a guy and she said, okay, this is it. And she sold everything and gave up her life and moved to Mexico,
Acapulco, right?
And then, like 10 minutes later, she came home and.
Right. Well, she was Robert Osborne, the host of Turner Classic Movies, is a dear friend of mine, and he was a very close friend of Hedy's. He was actually my very first interview for this book. But at any rate, he did tell me that she was a very capricious individual. She did things on the spur of the moment. It's incomprehensible to me, because I'm a pack rat and a sentimentalist, to do what Hedy did. She completely turned her back on her whole life in Hollywood, and she sold everything she had to marry Teddy Stauffers, who you're referring to, Mr. Acapulco, to marry him and pack up her children and herself and move to Acapulco with a marriage that didn't last but a year. And she's back to Hollywood trying to restart her career exactly where she had left off. To me, that sounds very radical, and her emotions and her mind thinking were very erratic at that particular time in her life. She was without a studio. She was without the protection of Louis B. Mayer guiding her career. She had made some dreadful mistakes. She made some dreadfully financial mistakes. And she had made an amazing comeback, if you will, in Samson and Delilah. And yet she made unusual demands with Paramount Studios and totally blew her chances at a stunning career comeback, a career that would last. So she was really spinning out of space when that particular incident happened.
Well, we're talking with Stephen Michael Shearer, and his book is called Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr, the Beautiful Actress. And, you know, today nudity in the movies is pretty ubiquitous, and it doesn't cast any aspersions on the morality of the actors who appear naked. But ecstasy really did brand Hedy Lamarr. How did ecstasy come to be?
Well, ecstasy was, Hedy was in love with a particular actor. Erebert Mogg, and Erebert Mogg and Hedy went to Czechoslovakia. She was offered this role in a movie called Extase, or Ecstasy, directed by Gustav Makati, very important Czechoslovakian film director. She read the script. She knew most certainly that there was a brief nude scene where she ran into a lake to swim au naturel, and then there was a scene that she had to simulate having sexual passion with her film lover, who was played by Erebert Mogg in that particular film. That movie, when it was released in 1933 in Europe, caused little stir, other than it was quite heralded as an important and major motion picture. It's actually shown primetime on Turner Classic Movies in its most complete form today, which does include those two particular scenes that I talked about. However, in 1935, when America was attempting to release that particular picture in this country, and Germany was attempting to release it in their country, there were certain issues that came about. In Germany, the issues were that most of the cast members were Jewish, so there was a lot of censorship, and that movie started getting a lot of press, censorship press, not because of the two scenes, which were not talked about, really weren't even mentioned in the reviews, but because of the Jewish actors and participants in that film. In the United States, we were a much more prurient society. We had censorship on the American screen. Nudity was absolutely forbidden. And so the movie, when it did finally win release in the United States, it was shown almost like a sideshow, a dirty movie. People lined up around the block to see this pornographic film. And it got a lot of notoriety for being a sex film at that time. But it was only in this country that ecstasy had gotten such bad notices. And Hedy, unfortunately, had that film, Ecstasy, to live down, if you will, the rest of her life. It's really quite a fine motion picture if you view it today.
And she looks fantastic in it.
Well, she's a little heavy, yes, but she's very, very young. But you can see a performance there. And you have to put your mind where that film was and in its place at its time. And in the 1930s, everything, that any bit of nudity was titillating and considered lewd. And unfortunately, this is something that Hedy had to live with.
Louis B. Mayer actually told her, we can't use you because you've appeared nude.
That's what he said, which was, you know, typical Louis B. Mayer, who's quite the hypocrite. If you ever do happen to see the 1924 version of Ben-Hur, A Story of Christ with Francis X. Bushman and Ramon Navarro, nudity abounds in that film. There's nudity throughout that whole movie, and that was a Louis B. Mayer MGM production in 1924.
Love it. It's a great picture.
Yeah, it is. It's almost as good as the 1959 version. Both of those films are classics.
Yeah. Well, in your book, you examine each of Hedy Lamarr's films in some depth, and as well as some of the missed opportunities. I want to talk about those in a bit. But let's talk a little bit about her great films. Which are the films you think we should seek them out?
Well, I think you know, there's such a resurgence now in these classic motion pictures of Hollywood's golden age, the 20s, 30s, 40s, even into the 50s. Turner Classic Movies, thank God for Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
People spend a lot of time watching Turner Classic Movies, and I think there is going to be a sway now back to nostalgia. All of Hedy's movies were A productions. They had, she starred opposite some of the most important leading men in Hollywood, of course, most MGM. Her most important films that I believe she should be seen in, H.M. Pullum Esquire, opposite Robert Young, a very obscure film. It's perhaps her best film performance, and if one watches that movie and excuses the lilting Viennese accent, one can see an actor at work. She does a brilliant performance in that, as she does in Tortilla Flat, which was an amazing film. It starred everybody who wasn't Hispanic, and they all played Hispanic workers in Northern California. It's an interesting film to watch, very studio film to watch. But Hedy's performance opposite John Garfield is a revelation. She really hands in a wonderful performance. Of course, Samson and Delilah is the classic that most people will remember her, if at all, for her film career. Those three films stand out, but I found even some of her worst projects, the two films that she actually produced herself, The Strange Woman and Dishonored Lady, dreadful motion pictures, but so much fun to watch.
Well, speaking of Samson and Delilah, my favorite story in your book, maybe you'll recall it for us, was she complained to the director, Cecil B. DeMille, that she felt that Victor Mature was upstaging her.
That's correct, and he was. Victor Mature was a very sly, very clever man. And she complained to C.B. DeMille, and C.B. DeMille took her aside and said, "My dear woman, you know, do you think that the viewing audience is going to be looking at Victor Mature, or be looking at, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, or be looking at your backside?" So I think that's the reference you're referring to.
Yeah.
But DeMille, you know, from any angle, Hedy was gorgeous to look at.
Groucho Marx said he didn't like the picture.
Groucho Marx, now I know what you're saying. Groucho Marx did make a remark to C.B. DeMille that he said something to the effect about this movie is perhaps one of the first time that I have ever seen a motion picture where the leading man's breasts are larger than the leading ladies. To that effect, that's what he said. DeMille didn't find that funny, but Victor Mature did.
And so did I. So.
Yes, well, it's made its rounds throughout Hollywood folklore.
We're talking with Stephen Michael Shearer, and his book is a biography of Hedy Lamarr called Beautiful, and he's also the author of a book about Patricia Neal.
Oh, yes.
But let me ask you, I'm a little confused about something in your book. Was Hedy Lamarr dishonest when it came to the alleged theft of her jewelry and the value of her jewels? Well, it's kind of unclear. What was her motivation?
Are you talking about the shoplifting incident?
Well, that also, but also...
There were innumerable times throughout her life, and one wondered, as a matter of fact, when I began my research, I kept wondering, is this woman psychopathic or what? Because innumerable times throughout Hedy's last 60 years, her jewelry would mysteriously end up missing. And just as mysteriously, it would show up again. Now, there were some honest times when the jewelry was truly stolen. But I don't know what this obsession, throughout her story, there was quite an obsession with jewelry. And I think Hedy correlated jewelry with security. And oftentimes, I think that she was, well, her dear friends told me in an interview, that she was just, you know, she just forgot where she put her jewels a lot of the times. And so I don't think there was anything deliberate there, but I did find it very strange that so many times in her life her jewelry ended up being stolen. In New York in 1950, there was a very famous case when she was staying at the Plaza Hotel. Indeed, her jewelry was stolen, but through further investigation, there was a whole round of jewelry thefts, a true cat burglar going through the hotels in New York at that time in the early 1950s. There were quite a few jewel burglary thefts at that time.
And what about her shoplifting incident later?
The shoplifting, I don't think, she was acquitted of that. Mm-hmm. And Robert Osborne said she was was there throughout the whole trial. And there were other close friends of hers at that time who said she was framed on that. I think Hedy did what she always did and just picked up objects and put them in her bag. And then on her way out, she would show her bag and say, charge these. This is what she had done for years, especially when she was with the studio system. But by 1965, 66, the stores didn't allow that anymore. There was no studio system at that time. And... So I think Hedy, you know, her acquittal said it all. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. I tried to tell the story as honestly as it was reported in the papers and as honestly as I got from people who were there. And one has to judge their own, make their own judgment on that. But indeed, she was acquitted of that.
Now, there's another side to Hedy Lamarr that I knew nothing about. I think most of the readers of this book will be surprised to learn. She helped fight the Nazis in World War II through her efforts selling bonds, but also as an inventor.
Yes, I think, you know, we had spoken, Gary, that she was a very brilliant woman. And when she was very, very young, she was married to the third richest man in Austria, munitions czar Fritz Mandl. Fritz Mandl was an older man, and she was indeed a trophy wife. And he did have his cronies over quite frequently at their luxurious apartment in Vienna, and night after night after night, Hedy would sit at the table and listen to their conversations about munitions build-up and armament, especially after 1933 when Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. Fritz Mandl was considered an honorary Aryan because he was, of course, Jewish, but he was supplying munitions to the fascist governments at that time, both to Benito Mussolini in Italy and to Hitler in Germany. And toward the end of Hedy's marriage with Fritz, she realized that he was really in a very precarious situation, jeopardizing both their lives. through his dealings with these fascists. And toward the end of the marriage, one evening, she listened to them talking about Hitler's plans for some sort of wireless communication so that Hitler could better arm his weapons of destruction. And she realized that she had to leave Fritz. She did leave Germany, rather Austria, and before the Anschluss of 1938, she didn't make it over to Hollywood. And then in 1940, as America was quickly approaching entry into World War II, there were quite a few incidents on the North Atlantic where torpedoes were missing their marks and not hitting the shipping. So Hedy originally wanted to meet eccentric music composer George Antheil because of a series of articles he had done about the endocrine system, the pituitary gland, and about breast enlargement, which Hedy was rather interested in. So she met with George Antheil at a dinner party at Adrian and his wife Janet Gaynor's home, and they brainstormed about the pituitary gland, and they kind of liked each other. And within days, they were brainstorming about the what was happening with the torpedoes missing their mark, and Hedy and Antheil came up with a patent, which they eventually took out in with the War Office, called wireless communication frequency hopping. The government didn't have a clue what to do with it, and it lay dormant throughout World War II. Hedy was very concerned about her mother, who was still in Austria, and through Louis B. Mayer and MGM's and the government's efforts, they did finally bring her over in 1942. But in 1959, the patent expired. Hedy and George Antheil just chalked it up as, well, it was our contribution to the war effort. 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the government had to readdress that particular patent to figure out how we could get messages between our ships in the blockade in the Caribbean. And then by the end of the decade, by the end of the 1960s, they had actually developed it into wireless communication with war weapons. As it has been developed throughout the years now, it is basically the essential nucleus of every cell phone and Wi-Fi in existence today. Hedy Lamarr died in the year 2000, and just 3 short years before that, in 1997, the international scientific community awarded Hedy Lamarr and the late George Antheil with their recognition. Hedy Lamarr was called one of the most brilliant women of the 20th century. And now on November 9, which is Hedy Lamarr's birthday, internationally, that is called International Scientific Day. And in India, where she is revered, it is actually called Hedy Lamarr Day. So who knew that a beautiful woman, and there's irony in that title of my book, Beautiful, mm-hmm. There was much more to Hedy Lamarr than just that beauty.
Absolutely. Now, although she did make many wonderful pictures, as you were discussing a little while ago, She also lost out on a few roles. She could have been Ilsa in Casablanca. She might have been Paula in Gaslight, two roles that Ingrid Bergman made her name in.
Absolutely. A lot of those, unfortunately, those pictures, well, Gaslight was an MGM film, but Casablanca in particular was a Warner Brothers film, and they definitely had Hedy Lamarr in mind for that particular role, but Louis B. Mayer was absolutely not going to lend her out at that time. He was still trying to mine money out of her film work, and he wasn't going to let her go. There were a few opportunities that Hedy actually passed, one of which was Laura. She did make a statement years later that if Billy Wilder, or excuse me, Otto Preminger would have offered her the film score to Laura instead of the script, she would have accepted it. But unfortunately, she didn't take that or the role of Maria in For Whom the Bell Tolls. She also had an opportunity to play the wanton miscast that Jennifer Jones portrayed in Lust in the Dust. What was the name of that movie?
Duel in the Sun.
Duel in the Sun, David O. Zelznick's Duel in the Sun. One only can ponder what Hedy Lamarr could have done with those particular roles. She did actually portray Ilsa in a Lux Theater, I think it was her last Lux Theater broadcast on the radio with Alan Ladd. Terrible bit of miscasting. But at least, you know, we got to hear what Hedy Lamarr could have done in the role of Ilsa.
She enjoyed some fame on the radio. It really made her a household name.
I'm glad you caught that. Yes, she did a lot of radio work. I was quite surprised and pleasantly surprised, certainly with her contemporary reviews and certainly with her film work and also with her theatrical work prior to her becoming a film actress. Her contemporary reviews were always very positive. She was in some very strange motion pictures, and one wonders whether Metro was trying to, or Louis B. Mayer was trying to sabotage her career at times, but she always gave exactly what the performance demanded. Robert Osborne and I talked about that at length in the book. I think in the preface he even mentioned, in the foreword he actually mentioned that. She did exactly what she was called upon to do, and when I give my lectures and my talks about film and about Hedy Lamarr, Patricia Neal, Hedy Lamarr, in reference to Hedy Lamarr, I usually show a clip from Ziegfeld Girl, because of all the three actresses, Hedy Lamarr, Lana Turner, and Judy Garland, who actually could have been a Ziegfeld Girl? Lana Turner was very short, and Judy Garland, well, she could sing, but Hedy Lamarr was gorgeous to look at, and she was a true, she did exactly what was required of her in that movie. She stood still and looked stupid, and that was...
it's easy to be glamorous, she said, right?
Yes, it's easy to be glamorous, just stand still and look stupid. She was not a stupid woman herself.
Now, next up for you, you've written about Patricia Neal and about Hedy Lamarr. What's your next project?
Well, I tell you what, I'm working on it right now. Unfortunately, I can't tell you. I haven't signed the dotted line at this point, but I have another book that I'm working on right now for St. Martin's, Thomas Dunn's St. Martin's Press, and it should be out next year, I think September of next year. But the thing is, I haven't, Gary, I haven't signed the dotted line yet, so I really don't, I really can't tell you. But it is certainly another major film biography, and I think motion picture is America's true art form, and I think that it's important that these people who have created our society, who have created our mores, our morals, and who've created who we are, they're so quickly leaving us. And the stars of Hollywood's golden age, they won't change the course of mankind, but their influence on our culture and on our society is most definite, and it's very important to me as a historian and to me as a film biographer to continue writing books about these great, great stars. Very objective, very comprehensive, complete biographies of these famous, famous stars.
Well, whoever it is, and I'm going to guess it's Mo Howard.
Well, okay.
I hope you'll come back and discuss it with us here on From the Bookshelf.
Well, I tell you what, Gary, I love to talk. I love to talk about film. I love to talk about my subjects, and it's really been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. As always, I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank Stephen Michael Shearer for being my guest this week. His new book is called Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.